This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Forget the first 100 days. The first 100 hours of the Trump administration are without parallel in recent memory. From immigration policy to trade, our place in the modern world seems to be evolving rather quickly.
One thing that has not changed is the analytical eye of our foreign policy contributor. The always level-headed Art Sear joins us in the studio today. Hi, Art. Nice to see you.
Well, thank you for having me back, as always, and Happy New Year to you and our colleagues here.
People talk about the first 100 days of a presidential administration. We are, as we're having this conversation, into the first 10 days of a presidential administration. Have you ever seen a 10 days like this?
Well, in terms of media attention, probably not, even during the Kennedy administration, where there was tremendous and very positive media attention, and it became kind of a love affair with President Kennedy and, in particular, the First Lady, Jacqueline Kennedy.
I'm not sure love affair is a term that many are using to describe these first 10 days.
No, absolutely. But I believe, and this reflects my bias, that there is an unholy alliance that's become very strong between President Trump and the media, and he plays the media like a violin. And I think it's fair to say that I don't recall anything that's been as disorganized, but in terms of his strongest supporters, it clearly resonates positively with them. The first 100 days of President Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, which you were alluding to, was a very different situation, a very different time.
There's been a fair amount written in recent days about the unelected team that's behind Donald Trump, primarily his advisor, Stephen Bannon. And there's some that refer to him as almost the de facto president. Is there any kind of precedent for the way power is being subsumed in the White House by these unelected advisory people?
I'm not sure that represents a dramatic shift from the past. I'm well aware that the media, reflecting the conversation we just had, is in an almost constant state of alarm, including public media, I'm sorry to say, not your program, over the latest outrageous statement or appointment. I think President Trump makes his own decisions. He's not as experienced in actual policy as any previous president. Even Barack Obama and George W. Bush were relatively inexperienced. I think he makes up his own mind. There have always been colorful personalities associated with the White House. That's not a change. And Mr. Bannon's interesting because my understanding is both parties were afraid of him. He had a fair amount to do with forcing out John Boehner and others that he saw as representing the Republican, quote, establishment, unquote. We'll see how much impact he has. I don't think he's known as an in-depth policy analyst or thinker. He is a kind of ideologue, but more in terms of personalities and broad vision.
Well, and so I wonder, at this stage of the presidency, so much has taken place by means of executive order.
Yeah.
Do things start to change when Congress needs to be involved?
Well, yes, and to some extent, the legacy of President Obama and also, to a degree, President George W. Bush. All presidents issue a lot of executive orders. There is always conflict with Congress. That's the way the founders designed our system quite brilliantly. We'll see how many President Trump puts in place. The problem with relying as heavily on executive orders, especially for broad sweeping regulations, as President Obama did, is you live by the executive order and they can be abolished very easily, which is why the very difficult, very hard process of passing legislation, which President Obama, whatever you think of his leadership, avoided. He did not like to do that and may not have been any good at it, frankly. Your legacy can very easily, with literally the stroke of a pen, be abolished. And that's what's happening.
Let's look at what's happening in kind of the world front. There was a very sudden, very public departure of a number of senior-level State Department employees.
Yeah.
There's obviously a story behind that that's not gotten told in as many words as it needs to. But what do you see happening on the international diplomatic front when you look at what happened there and pair it with Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of State?
I think that there's a lot of news about State Department discontent. I'm not sure how many people have actually resigned. It is not a new issue. The State Department traditionally does not have a powerful domestic constituency, especially when isolationism was still very strong, which is not the case today. It was a ready target. Joe McCarthy and friends, including Richard Nixon, not only constantly verbally, rhetorically abused the State Department, but did fire a lot of people. John Foster Dulles, as Eisenhower's Secretary of State, was extremely controversial, partly because of a house cleaning at the State Department. I don't think we've actually seen that yet, which is why we've got to look beyond the media.
When you look at the current state of things on that front and pair it with the current immigration and trade policy executive orders that have been made, and nominees for a variety of national security-related posts, do you see an end game for the United States in the world? You mentioned the word isolationist a minute ago. How does what we've seen from the Trump administration so far compare with these earlier isolationist examples?
I think it's too soon to tell. The two subjects are different. There has been a growing long-term protectionist trend in the United States since the Uruguay round was achieved by President Reagan and his special trade representative, Clayton Yoder, a remarkable leader from Chicago in part, and implemented during the first Bush administration. The follow-on negotiations, the Doha round in the 1990s, went nowhere, partly because agriculture is the toughest subject always, but also because protectionism has been generally growing in industrial nations. The TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, was politically dead in the water. Even though President Obama, in the last few months in office, kind of went on the political warpath to promote it rhetorically, at least. I don't think he had any meetings with notable legislators in either parties that went on in any depth. The TPP was dead long before President Trump trumpeted that it was going to be killed. I think that was purely a political gesture. The Chicago Council on Global Affairs, where I used to work, has done public opinion surveys since the 1970s, which really put us on the map, and they indicate clearly that there's no great protectionist trend in this country. In 1942, a few months after Pearl Harbor, the American people shifted profoundly from 90% or so protectionist to deciding we should play and must play an active role in the world, and we've never looked back. So I don't think, I think there are protectionist trends, but in terms of wider engagement in foreign policy, we're not becoming isolationist. The president has been widely and rightly, in my view, criticized for this apparently pretty sloppy executive order targeting specific Muslim countries and explicitly emphasizing the priority of the Christian religion. Even Speaker Paul Ryan, who's in a terrible bind, has, I don't believe Mitch McConnell, the Republican majority leader, has said anything, and he's been very careful about it, but Paul Ryan even has spoken out against this heavy-handed and gesture, which can be interpreted as a racist gesture. And we are not like that in this country.
Well, and so what does the upshot for, you know, what's the fallout for a gesture like that, if you will?
Again, I think it reinforces the president's standing with his base, which is by no means traditional conservative Republicans. He attracts a lot of people whose family heritage is voting Democratic and, at least in the past, industrial workers who had good jobs and good wages. He's appealing very strongly to that base constituency. Starting with his inaugural address, he has not been reaching out to widen his base, which to me seems unwise, but I'm constantly reminded by reality that I really am just a simple college professor who didn't predict what happened.
And the fallout for the U.S. on the world stage?
I think it plays to our worst negative stereotypes alive in the world. Heavy-handed, self-centered, self-indulgent. I do believe powerful allies of ours will continue to play more important roles in the world, and that includes even the Canadians. Not a major power, but certainly the Japanese and the British and the Germans, who each leader in a distinctive way, especially Prime Minister Abe in Japan, is trying to take advantage of the situation in positive ways to strengthen ties with the U.S. in diplomatic and security terms. I do think, for all this criticism, that there are opportunities for us to work more closely and positively with Russia, especially in the Middle East, where our national interests are very congruent.
There are some who have written, I think most prominently, David Frum in The Atlantic, about, you know, a potential model for pursuing an autocracy. Is that something that you're concerned about?
I don't think so. These trade agreements, starting with the economic institutions of the United Nations and then the European Economic Community, as it was originally called in the 50s, have succeeded in their primary goal, which is to, above all, reign in Germany and to some extent Japan, and to prevent another general war internationally. That was the main reason. That has been achieved. I believe that capital is so plentiful and so fluid, although a lot of people, including in this country, don't have enough. But on the macro level, capital is so plentiful and so fluid, and financial barriers between currencies have become so unimportant that private investment will continue to flow. And there the U.S. is the global leader, partly because of our collective talents, but also because those leaders in World War II made sure the U.S. dollar would become the lingua franca, financially, the basic exchange currency for the planet. Remarkable foresight. In great contrast to other nations, especially Japan, I think that that makes us paramount. We are the most productive and wealthiest and largest economy in the world in real terms, and we remain the number one magnet for foreign investment. And I think Trump can hurt that trend, but not even the President of the United States cannot unilaterally overcome it.
Art Sear, thank you so much.
Mitch, always a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Art Sear is a professor of political economy and world business. He's the director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He is also a regular Lake Effect contributor.